ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hi, this is Mike Behe, Senior Fellow with Discovery Institute. In 1996, I kicked over the hornet's nest with my book, Darwin's Black Box, and Discovery Institute has been there for me ever since. They've been there for a lot of us, and you make that possible by your financial support for Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery Institute needs your help now more than ever. Please consider giving a donation today to support the Scholars of Intelligent Design. To give, go to discovery.org/CSC2021. That's discovery.org/CSC2021. Thanks very much.
Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Eric Anderson, and I'm here again with Dr. Michael Behe, author of the brand new book, A Mousetrap for Darwin. Welcome back, Mike.
Thanks, Eric. It's great to be with you.
This book has been such a pleasure to read, and I've really enjoyed the responses you've provided to critics of your prior books. This is just a great resource for anyone who's interested in the debate over evolution and intelligent design.
Yeah, I've been wanting to pull all those responses together for a few years now, and it's gratifying to see it come out.
So in our last conversation, we talked about the blood clotting cascade and the responses you received from Richard Doolittle, Ken Miller, and Keith Robison. After we talked, I kind of stewed about this for the next few days, and frankly, I got more annoyed the more I thought about it. You know, here you were in 1996 pointing out this remarkable biological system and really bringing it into the public consciousness, so to speak. This is a system that's critical to our survival, that we can all relate to, that's shouting something significant about the Darwinian story and the need for design. A lot of generally lay people related to this example and talked about it and continued to discuss the blood clotting cascade in the years that followed. So it was great to see how many people became familiar with this amazing system.
Yeah, I myself was always astounded by it, you know, to think our lives depended on this very, very intricate system. And you know, it's great to be able to tell people about such things.
Yeah, that's the positive side of the coin. And then on the other side, the responses from the Darwinists in so many cases, such as Miller's, were certainly comical. But the thing that struck me as I thought about it more was that it was not just comical, it was sad. After your book, you know, what a great opportunity for researchers to help people understand this amazing system, to delve into the details, to marvel at its sophistication, to even learn from how it works as we seek to design our own systems. And yet the approach of the evolutionary biology community almost across the board was to just sweep it under the rug or nitpick definitions or make up stories. And, you know, that's a really sad state of affairs and kind of underscores the deep bankruptcy of the Darwinian paradigm in helping us understand these biological systems.
Yeah.
The approach, as you noted, was not just to help us understand, but to put up more smoke and mirrors and kind of a sad example of science stopping behavior in its own right. You know, don't offer any real analysis, just circle the wagons and pretend there's not a problem for Darwinism.
Yeah, that's right. It is a shame, but that's the world we live in. So we have to deal with it. And my approach is to get this data and these ideas out beyond the scientific community, which is resistant to it, and have more people understand it directly so that perhaps that'll change the narrative.
Right. Yeah, that's really good. A great approach and a good example. I guess the last point I would make is that these stories, these made up stories, is not just harmless. I mean, it's actively misleading the reader. Readers who read something like Miller's proposal about how the blood clotting cascade came about and take it seriously are actually worse off than if they hadn't read it.
That's right. Yeah. They're being made dumber.
So you know, that's kind of what bothered me, Mike. I mean, this is actively hindering people's understanding rather than contributing to the scientific enterprise. But anyway, I'll get off my soapbox now. But the more I thought about it, the more I was bothered by the fact that this wasn't just a case of, you know, gee, we have a disagreement among two smart people who are making good arguments. Instead, we're dealing with active obfuscation and, you know, really harming our understanding.
Yeah, that should make everybody's ears prick up when the other side doesn't just address or answer the question, but they wave their hands and blow smoke and call their critics names.
Well, I'll try to follow your patient example.
Well, you learn to be patient over time. You know, everybody's initial reaction is to be upset, but that doesn't help. So
Right. You
want to reach people who aren't necessarily the ones who are arguing against you. Mm-hmm. So in order to do that, you have to stay calm and proceed.
Excellent. Well, there are a lot of great additional details and excellent responses in your book on this topic of irreducible complexity and these wonderful systems we discussed. So I really encourage readers to go out and pick up a copy of the book. But let's dive into your second book now, The Edge of Evolution. So in 1996, in Darwin's Black Box, you had outlined irreducible complexity, the remarkable machinery at the base of life, and the challenge that these systems posed to Darwin's theory. Fast forward now to 2007, where are you taking your argument in The Edge of Evolution?
Well, yeah, I had written that there were things in life that certainly Darwin's theory couldn't account for, but that's not to say that it can't account for anything. It certainly, you know, might be able to. You know, there's always, there are mutations, birth defects, accidents happen all the time. So maybe one of those could help in some way. So what I wanted to do was find the borderline, what you might call the edge of evolution, between what required design and what might be accessible to just undirected random mutation and natural selection.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this is a really key point for our listeners to understand how critical this is. For generations, people have been studying evolution, building models, creating trees, speculating about how this or that system could have come about. But the simple question that I think should have been asked by every single evolutionist for decades, with maybe a few exceptions, was being widely ignored. And that simple question is, what can evolution actually accomplish? And the reason why that question was not being widely asked, and I think is another great real-world example of how the evolutionary paradigm functions as a science stopper, is that it was just assumed that evolution could do everything. Sure, we might need to tweak the explanation a little bit here and there, but under the assumption that evolution, broadly speaking, is true, under the assumption that all the remarkable biological systems we see came about through purely natural and material processes without any guidance or intervention or design, then it simply had to be the case that everything came about through some kind of evolutionary process. So, you know, this basic, obvious, central question that every researcher should have been asking was mostly ignored for decades. And, you know, frankly, a lot of researchers, and you could tell from your responses you got, we're kind of oblivious to this basic question, what can evolution actually accomplish?
Yeah, that's right. It's frustrating, but many Darwinists don't even get it. They say, well, here we are, you know, what's the problem? You know, of course, Darwinism's true. And you say, yeah, but the question is, can it explain this, or was there some other factor involved? And they say, but look, we have eyes and everything. You know, yeah, clearly Darwinism is true. So yeah, apparently Darwinism makes you unable to make distinctions, unable to see a lot of problems that other people see. So yeah, I didn't bother with that. I pretty much wanted to answer my own question, as same as you pointed out, you know, what can evolution mm-hmm. do? You know, it can do some things, you know, antibiotic resistance and stuff like that. So where is it reasonable for an unbiased observer to draw a line between what evolution can do and what requires purposeful design?
Right. Yeah. And let me set this up for our readers by quoting just a couple of sentences from the beginning of the next part of your book, kind of setting up the edge of evolution concept here. I'm quoting now. In the real world, random mutation, natural selection, and common descent might all be completely true, and yet Darwinian processes still may not be an adequate explanation of life. There must be a biological route to the structure that stands a reasonable chance of success in nature. In Darwin's day, scientists were ignorant of the many details of life, and so they could reasonably hope that evolutionary pathways would turn out to be short and smooth. But now we know better. If there is not a smooth, gradually rising, easily found evolutionary pathway leading to a biological system within a reasonable time, Darwinian processes won't work.
Yeah, that's exactly true. You've got to be able to, well, I think Richard Dawkins' image of Mount Improbable. He wrote a book called Climbing Mount Improbable. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, yeah, sure, it looks like it's got a sheer cliff from one direction. But if you go around the back, there's this gentle slope going up to the very peak. And well, okay, yeah, that's great. But we have to ask ourselves, is there a slope going up? And we all see the face, but in order for Darwin's theory to work, every structure that we discover has to be accessible by, quoting Darwin here, by numerous successive slight modifications. And if it can't, then Darwin's theory fails. And as you said, as in Darwin's day, they didn't know nearly as much about life as we do now. And now that modern science has gotten down to the nuts and bolts of life, the molecular level of life, then we have to reassess what it can explain.
As I said, as you said, I was quoting you.
Oh, whatever. Yeah. We got a feedback loop here now.
So one of the interesting responses you received was from Sean Carroll and Jerry Coyne, a couple of responses actually, who essentially argued that the need for multiple mutations at once to form some protein features was a red herring. We joked the other day in one of our prior conversations about having dinner at Biola conference many years ago when you were starting to look into this question of protein complexes. And this became a huge part of your second book. What do you mean by protein complexes and protein-protein binding?
Well, as many people may know, protein, it's something you eat, but also in the cell, proteins are machines or pieces of the machinery, the molecular machinery that keeps the cell running. Now, in our everyday world, when we have a machine, say a lawnmower or something, there are factories and there are intelligent agents, people who put the different pieces together. They put a bolt on here, snap another piece onto there. But in the cell, the pieces essentially have to assemble themselves into the machine. And that means they need to have surfaces between two pieces that are supposed to stick together to start making a machine. They have to stick to each other exactly and not stick to other pieces in the cell. And to do that, they have to have surfaces that are geometrically and chemically complementary to each other. You know, think of it as magnets. You have to have magnets at certain points in a piece exactly lined up next to other magnets in a different piece. Mm-hmm. And it turns out it would be a very difficult task for a Darwinian mechanism. So since that's a fundamental problem for evolution, I featured that a lot in The Edge of Evolution.
Yeah, and one of the things that you brought out that I think doesn't get a lot of attention, even in the ID community, is that these protein-protein interactions, as you say, require that these proteins can stick together, but it's equally important that they don't stick to everything else. I mean, if you had, you know, something thrown into the cell that stuck to everything, which is something that some of these folks had proposed as, you know, as a response, look, throw this in, it can stick to everything. Then you end up with a cell that's completely a mess.
Yeah, it's kind of like the old, you know, this is your brain on drugs or something, where you have a fried mm-hmm. egg. Yeah, if the proteins in a solution, like say an egg white or a regular egg, if they become able to stick to anything, then they do stick to everything and you get a kind of a congealed mm-hmm. mess and you do not get a baby chick from, say, a fried egg.
Yeah. So, you know, some of the critiques again from Carroll and Coyne didn't really address this important issue. And they kind of said, hey, we could certainly build things up step by mutational step. We don't need to worry about these multiple mutations. And yet Eugene Koonin, who's a well-known individual, acknowledged the issue and said this is the old enigma of the evolution of complex features in proteins that require two or more mutations, was the way he phrased it.
Yeah, that's right. It's fascinating when you write in this area, because if you say something, you know, pretty obvious, your opponents will rise up and say, oh, you're completely wrong. You know, it doesn't have to occur like this. Why look at this other pathway? And I say, well, I never denied that little things can occur, but they couldn't build up. And then somebody later comes along and says pretty much the same thing you said and gets all sorts of applause and said, yeah, look at that. Yeah, good point. Yeah. And Eugene Koonin, who's a very prominent scientist, did comment on a paper later talking about exactly the same subject that I focused on. And he says, this is an old mystery that, you know, this has been a longstanding mystery. But now here's a paper that addresses it. And
So tell us a little bit about this. Was this the Whitehead paper?
Yeah, well, there was a paper that said that, sure, it's difficult to get two mutations at the same time, but here's a possible route. Suppose you get the first mutation of two amino acids that have to change in a protein, and that doesn't give you the new property. But in the cell, the genes in DNA, they are what are called transcribed and translated into protein. They have the information, but it's the protein that actually does the job. And sometimes going from the DNA to the protein, you get mistakes there too. And they said, well, maybe the gene that has just one change sometimes makes another mistake in being transcribed so that you get a bit of protein that has that second mutation as well.
Sorry, you mean translated in the translation part?
Yeah, that's correct. Maybe I misspoke. Yeah, translated so that the protein, the product of the gene, then at least a bit of it has the correct sequence. And they called it a look ahead mutation. And Koonin thought this was really great because he thought it might get around this old conundrum of getting two necessary mutations at a time.
Mm-hmm. So what were some of the problems with this approach?
Well, pretty much everything. First of all, it really doesn't address much of biology, because if that first mutation was helpful to the cell, then it doesn't need this look-ahead effect, because natural selection could increase that, and then you'd have a greater number of those genes from which to get the second mutation. You'd just have a regular old Darwinian process. And if the first mutation were detrimental, then natural selection would select against that. And again, you wouldn't have that sticking around for very long to help out. So there's only an extremely narrow range of selection coefficients where that even theoretically could help. Mm-hmm. And additionally, suppose the first mutation took it in the wrong direction. Suppose that
it wasn't strictly neutral, right?
Yeah, that's right. If it wasn't neutral, then the thing wouldn't matter. But the most important thing is that we don't need these speculative models anymore. As I wrote in The Edge of Evolution, now we've got data. And as I wrote of the big example on The Edge of Evolution was the development of resistance to chloroquine by the malaria parasite. And we saw that in huge numbers of organisms, in 10 to the 20th or so malarial parasites over thousands of generations, none of these speculative models played any role. The only thing that happened was good old Darwinian evolution, where you get two crummy point mutations, and that did help, but it took an astronomical number of chances before it did. And as I wrote there, that would not be available to non-microscopic organisms. And so, that was unlikely to help.
Yeah. So it seemed to me that they were, you know, trying to slip an extra mutation in there for free. You know, we've got two ways the mutations can happen. So, not a problem. But in the end, is it fair to say that the old enigma, as Koonin called it, wasn't solved by this new paper?
That's right. Darwinism is great for one step, for going one step. But if you have to take two steps before you have an improvement, then it rapidly loses steam and pretty quickly is ineffective.
Yeah. You got to have massive numbers of organisms to search that space, right?
Exactly.
Well, Mike, it looks like that's about all the time we have for today. I'd love to have you back again for more discussion about this fantastic book.
Anytime.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ID the Future. For more information about the essential issues raised by Dr. Michael Behe and his responses to critics, get your copy of A Mousetrap for Darwin today in paperback or ebook format at online retailers like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Until next time, for ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.